I don't know about you guys, but when I was a little kid, it seemed like big holidays just happened. You know what I mean? Like Thanksgiving, I just sat down and there was a giant turkey and mashed potatoes and gravy and stuffing and corn and green beans and pies and cakes and the whole nine yards. And it was just there. You know, just one day, it was Thanksgiving. And it was time to eat. I mean, Christmas, there was a little more lead up and a little more anticipation and maybe it helped with the decorating. But frankly, as a little kid, you just kind of show up and ta-da, there it is. I mean, my dad said when he was really little, it was an extreme case of this. On Christmas Eve, there'd be nothing. And then Christmas morning, there was a train and a tree and presents and decorations and, you know, and the dinner was in the oven. I mean, everything was just there Christmas morning. Whereas before, everything was just the way it had been. Of course, there were also two very exhausted parents, right? And as we all know, these holidays, they don't just happen. The celebrations don't just happen without a lot of preparation. And I'm grateful that we have this time of Advent and we set it aside because just as the celebration, the festivities don't come off without preparation, if we're really going to take in what Christmas is really about, we have to prepare our hearts. As that great Advent hymn, Joy to the World, says, let every heart prepare him room. And we have to take the time, set it aside, to prepare our hearts for the coming of Christ. And that's why we do Advent. Not that the Bible tells us we have to. But I think we all know that on some level, if we didn't, Christmas would come and go. We'd have gained 5 pounds. We'd have a few more gadgets. And we otherwise would just move on with life as usual. But our prayer is that in all this time, we'll actually be able to stop, to reflect, to wait for the Lord. Advent comes from the Latin word for coming. You know, it's a time when we reflect back on Christ's first coming. Sometimes we look forward to his second coming. But it is a time for us to prepare. And so, as Kirk said, over the next few weeks, we'll be looking at the Gospel of Matthew and his infancy narratives, his stories that he tells here at the beginning of the life of Jesus. And so I have the distinct pleasure of preaching from what I think might be the most skimmed passage in all the Bible. I mean, when you think about it, it's right here at the beginning of the New Testament. So if you're going to read through, like, you got to read it. It's right here at the beginning of Matthew. So if you just wanted to read Matthew, you've got to read it. But it's a genealogy, that most skimmable of all biblical genres. I mean, frankly, we're just not that big a fan of genealogies, are we? But I think what we see in this genealogy is that Matthew really gives us a clue as to where he's going with this book. He gives us a clue as to what Jesus' coming was all about. You know, he tells us who Jesus came for in this genealogy. And I think he tells us why Jesus came as well. So we're going to take a little bit of time and look at some of the details of this genealogy. Now, genealogies, you know, boring pieces of literature to 21st century Americans. Apparently really exciting to first century Jews. Josephus, that's how he started his autobiography, with a genealogy. People loved their genealogies back then. They were important. They established your rights, your claims to things. They also were important for taxes. But this isn't just an interesting record for tax purposes. And if you look at it, you'll even see, as we look here, there are things in this genealogy that, frankly, don't need to be here. I mean, strictly speaking, from a first century Jewish perspective, ancient Jewish perspective, there are things in this genealogy that, frankly, you just don't need. For instance, the women in here. I mean, we may look at this and say, well, look, there's only 5 women in this genealogy. You have like 40-some guys and you have 5 women? Where are all the rest of the women? But in the first century, you look at it and say, like, why are there 5 women in this genealogy? You don't need 5 women. You don't need any women in this genealogy. Now, when you look at it and you say, well, okay, Mary, you can see why Mary's in there, right? The the progression of so-and-so, the father of so-and-so, or if you had a King James, so-and-so begat so-and-so, finally gets broken down at the end when Joseph does not beget Jesus. Joseph is not the biological father of Jesus, and so Mary is included. And we'll see a little bit more about that next week, of course. So Mary's inclusion is obvious. But the other four women, they're not just unnecessary from one perspective. They're also just downright strange. I mean, you think, why, of all the women you would include, would you include these women? Why not Sarah, Abraham's wife? You know, she gets a big thumbs up, but why these people who frankly highlight the scandal, highlight the irregularities in Jesus' lineage? I mean, Tamar, you start there at the verse 3, and you see Tamar shows up. Now, Tamar's story is not a G-rated story by any means. If you're not familiar with it, you can look back to Genesis, I think it's chapter 38, if you want to see the details. But, I mean, just to give you an idea of Tamar's story, frankly, it could have come right out of Jerry Springer. I mean, it's just a mess. So Tamar's is Judah, the patriarch Judah's daughter-in-law. And her first husband, Judah's son, apparently erred quite a bit in the sight of God. And so God killed him, put him to death. At that point, then, Judah's next son, Onan, was expected to marry Tamar. And the son that they had would then become Ur's heir. Well, Onan didn't want that. He didn't want to have a son who wasn't his heir. So he made sure that whenever he had relations with Tamar, that no pregnancy would ensue. Well, God wasn't very pleased with that, and so Onan was put to death. And then Judah looked at this and he said, look, I don't want any more of my sons being put to death. So he made some excuses. Well, we'll wait till the next guy gets old enough. But then he just kind of, you know, put Tamar on the side and let her sit. And Tamar decided to take matters into her own hands. And so Tamar took off her mourning garb and she dressed up as a prostitute, dressed up like a cult prostitute. And then she went out to where Judah was shearing his sheep, out to that area. And even if you don't know the story, you can guess what happens from there. Judah, being the upstanding guy that he is, sees this cult prostitute and you know, goes over to talk to her and find out how much for her services. So he promises her a goat, which he doesn't have with him. So he's like, well, here, take these things as security. Take my signet, take my cord, take my staff. They come back with the goat, and the cult prostitute's gone. A few months later, back in Judah's camp, somebody discovers, hey, Tamar, she's been immoral, and she's pregnant. Well, Judah is enraged. And this is the scene, like, I can picture this happening on Jerry Springer, actually. You know, like, there she is. She's sitting there, and Tamar's sitting there, and Judah's sitting there, and Jerry is like, Judah, we know you're furious with your daughter-in-law because she was out sleeping around, but there's something she wants you to know before you put her to death. Tamar, do you want to tell us who the father of your child is? You know, and she's like, the guy that this signet belongs to, and this cord, and this staff. I mean, talk about a sordid affair. Now, Matthew didn't have to mention Tamar. He could have just gone from Judah to his sons. And we would never have thought of this story, probably. We would have just skimmed through the begats, skimmed through the fathers. But instead, he highlights this sordid account, if you will. And then the next woman we see is Rahab, who was a prostitute. And then we see he lists Uriah's wife. And it's interesting, not simply that he lists Uriah's wife, but he calls her Uriah's wife. He doesn't just say Bathsheba. He highlights the fact that David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah. So he makes it inescapable that we stop and think about the fact that David was an adulterer and a murderer. I mean, without that, we might just read, you know, about David. Jesse was the father of David the king. And we might just think of David, this idealized king. You know, the king against whom all later kings of Israel were measured against. The one that they all looked back to. Oh, man, if we could have a king like David. But then you throw in the wife of Uriah, and you're like, oh, yeah, well, that David, but who also was, not always such a great guy. The fourth woman that you see in here, though, she doesn't seem to have any real taint on her like that, and that's Ruth. And it does make one wonder, why Ruth then? Well, Ruth has something in common. She also has something in common with these women, though. Ruth, of course, was a Moabite. Ruth was a Gentile. She wasn't a Jew. And so there isn't any scandal associated with her behavior. But no Moabites were allowed, according to Deuteronomy, no Moabites were to be allowed into the assembly of Israel. And yet, here is this Jew in the genealogy of Jesus. Frankly, even in the genealogy of David. And Tamar, she may have been an Aramean. Rahab was a Canaanite. And Bathsheba, even if she was a Jew, she's always associated with Uriah the Hittite. She's always so closely associated with this Gentile. And so Matthew, I think by including these elements into this genealogy, these unnecessary elements, it highlights the scandal. It also highlights the different kinds of people that made up the ancestry of Jesus, that made up the ancestry of the one who is the son of David, the son of Abraham, the one who is called Christ. And I don't think Matthew just wants us to see that this is where Jesus came from. But I think as he puts this at the very beginning of this book, he's trying to say, this is who Jesus came for. People like this. People with sordid, mixed up, messed up backgrounds. For men, for women, for Jews, for Gentiles. Jesus was coming for all of these people. Jesus was born to come for the very kinds of people he descended from. The kind of people who could end up on Jerry Springer if they'd only had the show then. But the other thing that this genealogy shows us through its unusual features is that Jesus has come for all kinds of people. But he's come, God sending him is the start of something huge, something momentous. That Jesus is the next big thing in God's plan for salvation, his plan for his people. Now, the very first verse kind of gives us some subtle indications of this. If we were all a bunch of first century Greek-speaking Jews who knew our scriptures, these first two verses, or this very first verse, would have some good hints for us about the significance of what's coming. The first thing is just the idea that it's called the genealogy of Jesus Christ. Back then, the genealogy, if it was going to be named, would be named after the oldest person in the genealogy, because they were the person of the greatest honor. You don't name it after the most recent person, except, of course, the reversal here. It's because Jesus is the goal of all of this. He is the most important figure, more important than Abraham, more important even than David the king. But the other thing which we see in the very first verse is actually even in the very first two words in Greek, which is the book of the genealogy. There's two words in Greek. That phrase, that Greek formula, shows up two times in the Greek Old Testament, right at the beginning of Genesis, in Genesis chapter 2, verse 4, and in Genesis 5, 1, where we read that these are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created. And then this is the book of the generations of Adam, when God created man. And the observant Jew who was reading in Greek, which most of them were at that time, would have heard that formula, the book of the genealogy, and would have called to mind this formula that God used right at the beginning. And I said, something big is happening here. That this is the start of something momentous, something on the same order as creation, possibly. But Matthew gets more explicit then as we look at the genealogy and we see the structure of it. Right? He bookends this mention of Abraham and David at the beginning and at the end, verse 17. And in verse 17, he tells us that he structured the genealogy. He says that Jesus was the Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. But in verse 17, we read, so all the generations from Abraham to David were 14 generations. And from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations. And from the deportation to Babylon to the Christ, 14 generations. And you think, well, that's nice, Matthew. Thanks for counting it for us. But Matthew wasn't just counting things. In fact, the genealogy we have is a structured genealogy. At one point, Matthew removes three kings in order to come up with these 14 generations in each block. Now, you may say, well, wait a second, isn't that a mistake then? The way genealogies worked back then, it was perfectly fine to say, you know, that this fellow begat this other fellow, who really was just his great-grandson. No problem. The point is that you have the line right, not that you have every single person counted. And so Matthew carefully structured his genealogy so that he could say there are 14 generations from these different significant points within Israelite history. I won't bore you anymore with like the explanations for why 14 generations. But I think what they point to is the idea that Jesus is the next big thing. He's a thing that people are waiting for. If God started his relationship with his people by reaching out to Abraham, and then 14 generations later, the great king David came on the scene, and that marked one period in Israelite history. And then 14 generations later, the next momentous event happened, the exile. Well, now 14 generations later, something else huge must be about to happen. And beyond it just being that Jesus is the next big thing, Jesus, I believe, this genealogy wants to point us in the direction of seeing that Jesus is the one who fulfills the promises God made to Abraham, the promises God made to David, and the promises of restoration that the exiles were looking forward to. So Jesus he's not just the next big thing, but he's the culmination, he's the climax of this history. So we see, of course, Jesus is the son of Abraham. He's the promised one. He's the one who's coming to his own people. But as we see in the promises that God made, that Yahweh made to Abraham, when he first established his relationship with Abraham, his covenant with him, he told Abraham that I will make you a great nation and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I'll be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And when he reaffirms that 10 chapters later in Genesis chapter 22, he says, your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice, and your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. There was a promise given to Abraham that was anticipating fulfillment. Of course, David was given a promise that was waiting for fulfillment. Before David died, he was promised by the Lord that the Lord would establish his house forever, that he would raise up an offspring from David who would sit on his throne forever. We read this in 2 Samuel 7, that the Lord declares to you that the Lord will make you a house. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. And then we read a few verses later, and your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. Again, there was a promise, an anticipation, something waiting for fulfillment. But the next big event that Matthew highlights in all of this is the deportation, the exile, which would have been the low point, the nadir of Israelite history. Didn't take long after David before the kingdom split, and then the northern kingdom, they rebelled and they were taken off into exile. And those that remained then, around 600 BC, around 597, Judah, the southern kingdom, the Jews who still remained, what we see here is Jeconiah. He was carted off to Babylon. And a few years after that, then, Jerusalem fell. And the people were taken into exile. And in some sense, the exile, you could look at the exile and say, well, is that the end of the promises? Is that going to be it? Is that the end of the promise to Abraham? Is this the thing that's going to stop it? You know, where's the one who's going to come now to be a blessing to the nations? Or the king? There's no more kingdom. But God wasn't destroying Israel, and he wasn't backing out on his promises. The exile was God's punishment for Israel, for Judah's persistent disobedience, for their failure to honor the covenant God had made. And yet God promised that he would restore them, that he would bring back a remnant. But we need to think about what exile meant. What was it all about in the first place? We don't think often of the exile. Like I said, it was a punishment for their disobedience, but it was also a prophesied event. But long before the prophets who keep warning them, Moses warned the Israelites of what was going to happen to them. In Deuteronomy 28, he tells them, "But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord your God, or be careful to do all his commandments and his statutes that I command you today, then all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. The Lord will cause you to be defeated before your enemies. You shall go out one way against them and flee seven ways before them, and you shall be a horror to all the kingdoms of the earth. A nation that you have not known shall eat up the fruit of your ground and of all your labors, and you shall be only oppressed and crushed continually. And the Lord will scatter you among all peoples from one end of the earth to the other, and there you shall serve other gods of wood and stone, which neither you nor your fathers have known." And that's what happened to the Israelites. So they didn't keep the word of the Lord. They didn't abide by the covenant, by the relationship that he made with them. But Moses also tells them in Deuteronomy that when these curses came upon them, if the people returned to the Lord with all their heart, that God would restore them, that he would gather them back from the nations. We read then a couple of chapters later that the Lord your God will bring you into the land that your fathers possessed, that you may possess it, and he will make you more prosperous and numerous than your fathers. And the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your offspring, so that you will love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, that you may live. The Lord your God will make you abundantly prosperous in all the work of your hands. God promised that he would bring the people back. And they would be able to, that their hearts would be circumcised, that they would be able to worship him, and that they would enjoy abundant prosperity even beyond what they knew before being scattered. These promises then were taken up by the prophets who anticipated this reality after exile. That after the exile, that the people would have this new reality. That there would be a time of unparalleled prosperity. But also, as Jeremiah says, that the law would now be written on their hearts. Or as Ezekiel says, that they would have a new heart of flesh. So they'd be able to do the will of God. When you look at it, the history, though, of the Jews, and you see that in 539 or so, they were allowed to come back. Some of them were allowed to return from Babylon. They came back, though. The exile was over, you might say, as more and more came back. And yet, in some sense, they were very acutely aware that the exile still hadn't ended. That they were still awaiting restoration. When you read Ezra, you read Nehemiah, you see that the curses of Deuteronomy are still in effect. Nehemiah chapter 9 says, "Behold, we are slaves this day in the land that you gave to our fathers to enjoy its fruit and its good gifts. Behold, we are slaves, and its rich yield goes to the kings whom you have set over us because of our sins. They rule over our bodies and over our livestock as they please, and we are in great distress." The exile, even though they were back, in some sense, the exile wasn't over. They were back in the land and still exiled. They were back in the land and still waiting for God to restore them. The people were still sinful. They were still waiting for this circumcision of the heart. They were still waiting for this new covenant that Jeremiah promised. They were still waiting for this new birth that Ezekiel foretold. And they experienced all the external curses as well. I mean, from the time that they got back into the land of Israel, the Jews never really, they never really had the kind of thing that the prophets foretold. They were always under the thumb of somebody, whether it was the Seleucids or the Ptolemaids. They had a little respite when their own people, the Maccabeans, ruled. But they were scoundrels too. And then after them, it was the Romans. And so when Jesus comes on the scene, when Matthew writes this genealogy, right before we see Jesus' birth, the people are still feeling the exile is there. They're still feeling the effects of it. They're still feeling the effects of their sin, the alienation from God, the fact that they're not enjoying the blessings of God. They're not enjoying the promises. They're still feeling the effects of the curse. But Jesus then, as we said, goes from Abraham to David to the exile. And now Jesus. Jesus is God's next big thing in the history of his people. Jesus is the one who will fulfill those promises anticipated. Those promises that people are looking for fulfillment. The promises to Abraham. The promises to David. As we see later, in Jesus, all the nations of the earth are being blessed. The Gentiles come to him. Come to God through Jesus. The promise to Abraham is fulfilled. Jesus is the one who comes, who lives, who dies, who is raised again, and then sits at the right hand of the Father, who is enthroned forever. The promise to David fulfilled. He's also then the one who fulfills the expectations, the longing, the promises of those who are still languishing in exile. For all those who see the taint of sin, how it's pushed them away from God, how even if they're in the land, that the relationship isn't back the way it's meant to be. Jesus is the culmination. He's the next big thing. He's the climax of the history of Israel. He's the climax of history. And that's what Christmas is about, is the coming of Jesus into the world. To be the one who brings an end to our exile, who brings an end to our alienation from God, who brings an end to what sin has done in our lives. And he does this for anyone who comes to him, a Jew or a Gentile, man or woman. Whether your family tree is as sordid as his was. And if you think of Christmas and you don't think of good times growing up, but you think, oh man, we were just hoping nobody kill each other. Well, Jesus came for families like that. You know? Jesus came for families that didn't celebrate Christmas at all. And Jesus came to restore people to God. He's the one who puts an end to our exile. He was God's next big thing. But as Christians, we also know that he is God's next big thing. That Jesus came to put an end to the exile, to the alienation because of sin. But Jesus is coming again to bring the culmination of the restoration, to bring all the rest of the promises to bear. Jesus was and is God's next big thing. Amen. Let's pray.